Grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Okay, tonight our 40-minute speaker is Patty O. from Laguna Beach.
Thank you. I'm Patty. I'm an alcoholic. I'm grateful to be sober. I'm grateful to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to thank you for inviting me and giving me an opportunity to participate in my recovery. I just want to re-invite all of you to go to AOCYPAA.org. So that you can join me and Casey at the dance. And if you're afraid you won't remember it, for $2 you can buy the CD. It's not recorded. Everybody's happy now. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I was standing here before or during the break listening to the music of Alcoholics Anonymous. Everybody talking, nobody listening. And the laughter and everything that goes on in this room it's electrifying. And if you're new here tonight, I hope you find a little of that electricity. I like the fact that you put the Al-Anon in the front row. They need to learn to pay attention. Whenever he explained to me where he lived in Texas, I glazed over during that. I don't know if you guys talk to many Al-Anons, but they tend to glaze over when they're talking to you. It's somewhere down there. Whenever I do this, I talk to my sponsors. I particularly talked to her today. I had an incredibly emotionally draining day for me. And for alcoholics, anything emotional is draining. And we don't handle emotions well. We drink. If you have a feeling sneaking up on you, you have a drink. A little feeling creeping around the corner, have a drink. We don't like feelings. We like to be numb. And so when you first get sober and you start having those feelings, it's scary. And when you're 37 years old and you start having feelings, it can be scary. And that's why 37 years sober, I'm actively sponsored. Because I had to be on the phone with my sponsor a lot today. It's had a very emotional day, and I'll tell you about it, I hope. I mean, I always like speakers who do that, and then they never tell you what it was about. And if you're anything like me, you spend the whole meeting going, what was she upset about? What was she upset about? I didn't really listen to anything else. What was she upset about? So I'll just tell you up front. I had to resign my position on Monday, and I've been working in the same place for 22 years. And Monday, due to some circumstances beyond my control, it became necessary because it was the right thing for me to resign. And I don't do the right thing. I do the easy thing. I do the thing that makes me feel good. And so Monday, I did the right thing, and I resigned my position in 22 years. And I had to pack up an office that I found dust balls that were 21 years old. And it was very, very, it's like, somebody said it's like your child going off to college. Yeah, I don't know, mine went to Skid Row, but it's not like that because I didn't know it was going to happen. It was more like a death. And so I'm going through a grieving process. But the good news for me is that I have you. The good news for me is that I have Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a kit of spiritual tools that allows me to feel this, that allows me to experience this, that allows me to walk through this. I don't have to pick up a drink. And for that, I'll be eternally grateful. My friends haven't been too thrilled with me in the fetal position, you know, bawling for the last 3 days. They ask me what I want for dinner, and I start to cry. That hasn't pleased them, but they've been there for me, and they will continue, because that's what we do here. We just are here for one another. So I talked to my sponsor today a lot. And when I told her I was going to be here tonight, she said the same thing she always says to me when I'm going to share at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. She always gives me the same direction. You think they'd get a little more creative. You know, you think they'd come up with something a little fancy every once in a while. But I know the women I sponsor don't have this complaint, but sponsors are typically very boring people. They kind of get a line and they stick with it. And her direction to me every time is the same. Tell them your name and tell them the truth. I've told you my name. I'm not so sure I'm going to tell you the truth. And the reason for that is clear to me. I don't know about anybody else in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I never knew that what it used to be like was going to be important. If I would have known when I was out there that I would be here tonight expected to report to you what it used to be like, I would have paid more attention to my life. If I would have known I was going to be here reporting, I would have taken notes. If I would have known about steps 4 and 5, I can tell you I would not have done some of the things that I did. But I didn't know it was going to be important, so I didn't pay a lot of attention. Coupled with that, the job that I've had for the last 22 years, I had to get a fingerprint clearance for my job. I fingerprint really, really well. I'm good at fingerprinting. I roll right along with the printer. I don't go too fast. I don't resist it. I just roll right along. And I was rolling along, getting printed, and I didn't want to raise any red flags. So I very casually said to the woman doing my printing, I said, "Well, how far back are you going to check?" And she looked me in the eye and said, "From the day you were born." And I thought, oh my God, it's like a fifth step, only it's in the wrong order, because they're going to know about it before I do. And the book Alcoholics Anonymous says more will be revealed. It doesn't say how. So the woman called me when my report came back. This woman called me. And I don't know, do you talk to many non-alcoholics? I don't. But non-alcoholics, they tend to be a little hesitant when they talk to us, especially if they're going to give us what they believe is bad news. And she was really hesitant when she called me that day. And she said, "You know, your report came back." And I said, "Uh-huh." She said, "You know, normally these reports are 2 or 3 pages long." I said, "Okay." She said, "Yours was 56 pages. And she asked me if I wanted to see it. Well, of course I did. So I went down there and I read that report. And I can tell you this, I know a lot more about what it used to be like, having read that report, than I did before that. So this story may or may not be true. It's been reported, some of it's documented, but I like the story, so I just keep telling it. And here's how it goes. I had my first drink of alcohol. I didn't have my first drink of alcohol until I was 13 years old. And I'm really sorry I waited that long. But I had absolutely no idea what alcohol would do to me or for me. I grew up in an alcoholic home. I didn't know it was alcoholism. I thought my dad was weird. I had no idea it was alcoholism. Nobody talked about alcoholism. So I didn't have any of those preconceived, "I'm never going to drink." And I never had any of those, "I can't wait until I drink" idea. I just don't remember ever thinking about alcohol at all. And yet I'm 13 years old and I remember as clearly as if it happened tonight. We were camped on the beach just south of here in Oceanside. And I remember very clearly getting into the tent that Friday night. And in my pillowcase, I had a bottle of vodka. To this day, I don't know where that bottle came from. I've always believed it was the grace of God. But I've never been able to confirm it. And I had no idea what alcohol would do to me or for me, but I remember being excited about having it. And the book Alcoholics Anonymous talks about a sense of ease and comfort that comes before we even take the first drink. And I had a sense of ease and comfort holding that bottle of vodka. And I asked if anybody wanted any, and they didn't. And the reason they gave me for not wanting it was all we had to mix with it was grape soda and root beer. And I said, "Well, so what?" And I took off the top, and I drank half the bottle, and I looked around the tent. Nothing had gotten different. Nothing had changed. So I drank the second half of the bottle, and that was to be the end of my social drinking. Never again after that day did I ever offer anybody a drink out of my bottle. And I don't know about anybody else in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I never had resentments until I came here. I never had resentments out there. But one of my early resentments in Alcoholics Anonymous is I heard you talk about your first drink, and you described it. You described this warmth as it circled around in your mouth, and you talked about how it felt as it trickled down your throat. And it hit your stomach, and it exploded, and it went to your fingernails and your toenails, and you grew a couple inches, and you dropped 20 pounds, and your pimples fell off, and wonderful things happened to you, and that simply wasn't the case for me. I had my first drink of alcohol, and absolutely nothing happened to me for about 15 minutes. And at the end of the 15 minutes, the only thing that happened to me is I had to go to the bathroom, and it's my belief tonight that if you were to drink a quart of anything in about 15 minutes, you'd have to go to the bathroom. So I got out of the tent, and I shuffled through the sand to the outhouse, and I went in and went to the bathroom. And when I got done and went to get up, I realized I was absolutely, totally, 100% paralyzed to the toilet seat. I couldn't move. I couldn't even blink. I didn't feel my heart beating, and I was overcome with a sense of fear. And, of course, the fear was that somebody else is going to have to come use that outhouse, and there I was, paralyzed to the toilet seat. Later in my drinking, I would discover that two people can use the same toilet at the same time. The second person's got to be incredibly careful, but I didn't know that at 13. I did somehow know that the body was made up of energy. And I somehow figured if I could gather my energy, I would be all right. So I've always referred to it as my first formal meditation, because I sat and I gathered my energy. And when it seemed to be in one place, when it seemed to be centrally located, I just sort of fell off the toilet, out the door, into the sand, and started crawling back to the tent. Now, when I came here, you explained to me my entire problem that night was my attitude. If my attitude would have been right, I could have had a fantasy. I was in the Marines, I was being dive bombed as I was trying to get back to safety. And if my attitude would have been right, it could have been a wonderful experience. Now, in my own defense, I have to tell you, my pants were still down at my ankles. I had started to get sick. I couldn't quite get through it. I couldn't get around it. And I've always contended under those circumstances, it's a little difficult to have a good attitude. I did somehow manage to get back to the tent. I fell in and I passed out. And when I came to in the morning, I realized nobody was in the tent with me, and I couldn't figure out where they went until my eyes cleared enough that I realized I'd been sick all night long. I'd hit the top of the tent, the side of the tent, like you've never been sick. I hadn't missed a square inch, and quite frankly, I didn't want to be in there either, so I got out of the tent. And that was my first drink of alcohol. And it was the most amazing, incredible, marvelous, magnificent, wonderful spiritual experience I'd ever had. And it must have been because I put some amount of alcohol into my body from that day until the day I came to the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't always get drunk, and I didn't always drink the kinds of things that you would classify as a beverage. I drank a lot of vanilla extract. I used to buy it by the six-pack. I just recently found out that they make vanilla extract without alcohol in it anymore, which I think is a total ripoff for our children. Now, I remember the day the guy at the market called me over. He said, "Patty, I can't let you buy vanilla extract anymore." He says, "I can't believe anybody bakes as much as you do." And I got cut off from that supply. I drank a lot of mouthwash. I drank a lot of perfume. Taboo became my after-dinner drink of choice. I still have a weakness for it. If you're wearing it, I may follow you too closely and laugh at you. But, you know, alcoholics, we know, how do we know that stuff? We know stuff that other people don't know. My next-door neighbors who are not alcoholics, they've been to my house a few times. They've never once eaten or drank a single thing out of my bathroom. But we just sort of intuitively know. I'm a bar drinker. I'm a living room drinker, an alley drinker, a car drinker, a backyard drinker, an office drinker, a dumpster drinker. I don't really specialize in this drink. But I love bars. I love sleazy, nasty, disgusting bars. And I know you got some here because I've been in them. I like those ones with sawdust on the floor. The mirrors are cracked. You kind of have to dip around to see yourself in there. Posting around the bars ripped, or people try to hold on as they're falling off their bar stool. It's nice if there's a piece of broken furniture in a corner somewhere. And they used to be full of smoke. I understand you can't smoke in a bar in California anymore, which makes absolutely no sense to me. I drank in bars for guys to take a piss against the wall. Apparently they can still do that, but they can't smoke. But they used to be full of that smoke and that wonderful used booze urine smell that I salivate still. I love that smell. I have friends who go to morning meetings for attitude adjustment. I go buy one of those joints and open the door and take a puff off of that. That just perks me up. I don't need an hour of recovery. One hit off of a sleazy bar and I'm good for the day. What I'm fascinated by is the quality of people who drank in those places. I mean, there were CEOs of really big companies, bank presidents, admirals in the Air Force, neurosurgeons. I mean, that's what they said they were. But we weren't sitting around having conversations like, "Well, what do you prefer, the red mouthwash or the green? Well, what's your preference, Chantilly or Aquavelva?" We weren't having those kinds of conversations, so it doesn't occur to me I'm living any different than anybody else. I think I drink because I want to drink. I don't know that I don't have a choice. I don't know that at 13 years old I put alcohol into an alcoholic body. And from that day on, I have no choice. I thought I drank because I wanted to drink. I had an opportunity to go to college. I went to San Diego State. Graduated from San Diego State with a 3.8 grade point average. And I share that with you for this reason. It almost killed me in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because when I got here, I told you I was too smart to be an alcoholic. I can tell you in retrospect, I was a chronic, hopeless, helpless alcoholic. I was a blackout drinker. I love blackouts. I love blackouts. I wish we could have blackouts sober. I love, there's nothing more exciting for me than leaving work on February 12th, going back on February 18th, and discovering I'd been there the entire time. I'm a chronic alcoholic blackout drinker, and I graduated from college with a 3.8 grade point average. I stayed in San Diego and took classes for a master's degree. I'm one of those people, I'm doing something well, I want to keep doing it. So I stayed and took classes for a master's degree. I left San Diego because I had taken all the classes San Diego State has to offer. My disease manifests itself in rationalization, justification, and denial. No matter what it is I do, I explain to you why I'm doing it. As I'm explaining it to you, I'm hearing it. As I'm hearing it, I'm believing it. And I think I'm leaving San Diego because I've taken all the classes San Diego State has to offer. I don't think I'm leaving because I have a roommate who's a little annoyed with me. And here's the thing. As a chronic alcoholic, even in the worst of my alcoholism, I have always had a tremendous amount of compassion. And the guys who drank in the bars that I drank in, and if this offends you, I guess you deserve it. I don't know what else to say about this, but the guys who drank in the bars that I drank in, they had very little creativity. They had two basic lines. My wife doesn't understand, and I have no place to stay tonight. That was typically the end of their creativity. So I had all this compassion. So some guy would come on to me with one of those lines, and I would say, listen, I'll take you home with me tonight, but I don't want to talk to you again until the bar closes. So the bar would close, being a lady of my word, I would take him home with me. We'd get to my house, I'd send him into the bedroom, telling him I had to go to the bathroom. He'd go into the bedroom on the right, I would go into my bedroom on the left, and I had just sent him in with my roommate. Now, some nights it was okay with her. Some nights she didn't mind at all. Other nights, within a matter of minutes, there'd be all this banging on my bedroom door, which I had, of course, locked. I had 7 o'clock classes. I got to get some sleep. And if it would have always been all right or never been all right, I'd have been okay. But she was so inconsistent, you'd have drank if you lived with her. She was so inconsistent. I don't think I'm leaving because she's annoyed with me. I think I'm leaving because I've taken all the classes San Diego State has to offer. I don't think I'm leaving because I have one more drunk driving assault charge pending. Another resentment I got in Alcoholics Anonymous. I found out here you can get arrested for a single charge of drunk driving. I always got arrested for drunk driving assault. And it had something to do with how I got out of the car. And here's the thing, I'm driving down the street, the light comes on behind me, I pull over, the officer walks up, I slam my car door open. Now my intent is to knock him in the private parts. But men are a little fussy about their private parts, so as the door's flying open, he jumps back to protect himself. And when he jumps back, it's really a good thing, because now he's far enough away that I can get him in focus. And I think one of him, one of me. One of him, one of me, I think I can take him. One of him, one of me, I think I'll try, and I would go for him. And it would be a really good fight. And I was a lot younger then, but it was a really good fight for a couple of minutes. But I wouldn't remember that back at the car, he had a friend. And the friend had a radio, and the friend would call some more friends. And pretty soon it would be 2 or 3 of them, one of me. It's not fair anymore, say uncle, and they take me away. And the next time the light comes on behind me, I pull over. The officer walks up. I slam my car door open. Try and knock him into private parts. He jumps back to protect himself. He gets far enough away and get him in focus. And I think, one of him, one of me. One of him, one of me, I think I can take him. One of him, one of me, I think I'll try and go for him. Good fight for a couple of minutes, but I wouldn't remember the friend, the radio, and the friend's friend. And pretty soon it'd be 4 or 5 of them, one of me. It's not fair anymore. It's simple, and they take me away. I didn't do that once or twice. I did that 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 times. I never remembered the friend, the radio, and the friend's friend. And that's the insanity of my disease. The insanity of my disease is I do the same thing over and over, and I think the results are going to be different. This time it's a fair fight. This time I'm going to take him. And when you get out of the car like that, they attach an assault charge. They don't even care that they won the fight. They're driving assault. And I don't know if it was a good thing or a bad thing, it just was. I drank during a time when the state of California did not get their underwear in such a knot about drunk driving. I understand they're pretty testy about it now, but I never had any consequence. Well, they took my license from me, but you don't really need that to drive a car. I never really had any consequences. I'd pay an attorney $1,000, which was a lot of money, but and he'd make a phone call, he'd write a letter, and that'd kind of be the end of it. I'd never hear any more about it. But one time I had two pending at the same time, and my attorney was nervous. And I think if your attorney's nervous, you should worry about it. So I'm sitting in a bar worrying about the fact that my attorney's nervous. And I started talking to this guy next to me, and as luck would have it, he worked in a mortuary. And I came up with a plan. I think we come up with really good plans really quickly. Now, the problem for me is typically my solutions are worse than the original problem, which is why I'm actively sponsored, because still today, my solutions can be worse than the original problem. But I didn't have a sponsor then, so we went over the mortuary. We got a death certificate. We put my name on it. We filled out all the pertinent information. We forged a doctor's signature, and we sent it to the court, because they can't expect a lot from you if you're dead. And I called my attorney and told him he didn't need to worry. He didn't worry. I didn't worry. Nobody worried for, I don't know what it was, 30, 60, 100 days. I don't know what it was. The light came on behind me again. And this time, the judge wanted to see me. And I couldn't figure out why he never wanted to see me before, but you know what? I'm game. I'll go. And I'll never forget him looking at me. He said, "Miss Ochoa, tell me, how is it a dead person to stand in my court?" And I shrugged my shoulders, and with all sincerity, I said, "I don't know. Bad luck." And that's what I thought it was. It was bad luck. It was circumstances and conditions. It was the cops. It was you and they and them. It was a lot of things. It never occurred to me anything to do with alcohol. Never occurred to me. And I don't think I'm leaving San Diego because I have one more drunk driving assault charge pending. I think I'm leaving because I've taken all the classes San Diego State has to offer. I was offered a job in Chico, California. I loaded everything I owned into my car, took some beer, some booze, and headed north. I got to Santa Ana, which isn't the place you want to shoot for, but I got to Santa Ana, I was out of booze, and I was thirsty. I pulled off the freeway. I have a sense I can find the sleaziest bar without even looking for it. I pulled into the parking lot of this place. I walked in. It was full of smoke. Had that wonderful used booze, urine smell. Willie Nelson was singing on the jukebox, and I knew I was home. That's as far north as I ever got. 88 miles from where I started from. Alcohol had become my mother, my father, my God, my friend, my lover, my companion, my support. And at some point it had turned, and I've always believed it was in the middle of my first drink. At some point it had turned and began to strip me of self-esteem, self-worth, dignity, honesty, integrity, pride, all the things we have going for us as human beings. And long before I got to you, it had taken it all. Long before I got to you, alcohol controlled every area of my life, where I would live, where I would work, the people I would run with, and eventually the people I would run from. And I didn't have a clue. I thought I drank because I wanted to drink. I didn't know that I didn't have a choice. I went into the profession of my choice. I rose very quickly to the top, and that too almost killed me in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because when I got here, I told you it's too successful to be an alcoholic. I told you about the trophies and the plaques. What I didn't tell you about, I was in the newspaper business, and we often gave awards, and we often won awards. But I didn't tell you about the times that I would come out of a blackout standing behind a podium much like this in a room full of people holding an award, not knowing if I was giving it or receiving it. And so I would say thank you, and I would go sit down, and then somebody would elbow me and tell me I was presenting it to the Kiwanis Club, and I'd have to get up and start over again. And I didn't tell you that. I just told you I was too successful to be an alcoholic. In 1975, the state of California started to get a little testy about people barreling down the freeway at 80 miles an hour, blowing something in the breathalyzer above their grade point average. And I got pulled over one more time, and I was taking the field sobriety test. I'm good at field sobriety tests. I practice field sobriety tests. I'm one of those people, I get released from jail, I get the arrest report, I read it, I find out where I made my mistakes so I can practice that part so that next time I'll get that part right. And I always knew there'd be a next time. I always knew because the cops were always looking for me. I had a very high-profile job. They were always looking for me. They knew what I drove. If I had my car, your car, company car, a stolen car, they always knew what I drove, and they were always looking for me. So I practiced field sobriety tests a lot. When I prayed God was my last drunk driving assault, I was doing a great job. I even mentioned to the officer I thought I was doing A-plus work. I mean, by then I knew touch your finger to your nose means this. It doesn't mean that. I know how to walk field sobriety. Tonight I can stand on one foot for 45 minutes. I am good at field sobriety tests. And at the end of it, the officer asked me to say the ABCs backwards. Well, the time before I had responded with, well, I can't even do that sober. Well, then I had just confessed. So on what I pray God was the last one, when he asked me to say the ABCs backwards, I said, okay, and I turned around. See, you think it's funny. He wasn't even amused. I was turned around, he cuffed me, took me to Orange County Jail. He put me in a cell with criminals. I mean, there were like real criminals in there. They were like prostitutes, burglars. Women who've been arrested for beating their husband, which I don't think should be a crime, but in California they locked you up for it. And I knew I didn't belong there, so I tried to organize a prison break. And I explained the plan very carefully and very slowly to the criminals. It was an easy plan. We're going to get our coffee cups, we're going to bang them on the bars, and the marshal comes to see what's going on. I'm throwing my arm around her neck, we're getting her keys, and we're getting out of here. I explained it very slowly, and I heard something I was to hear in Alcoholics Anonymous. One of those criminals looked at me and she said, why don't you sit down and shut up? I said, fine then, y'all stay, but I'm getting out. I was going like a mad woman on those bars. Couple problems with styrofoam cups. First one is they don't make a lot of noise. Second one is the bars have a tendency to eat them up. The bars ate them up and it got to my knuckles and it got painful. I sat down and I shut up. I got released on an OR. I hadn't been released on an OR in a long time, but I knew they were making a mistake. I didn't think I should be the one to tell them about it. And I went to court on that charge. I was 26 years old in court. I was drunk in court that morning. It's the only way I went to court. The only way I went to work, the laundromat, the grocery store. It's the only way I did anything. Stood there drunk in court that morning because the state of California was starting to get upset. And they were handing out some serious consequences because of my past record as being sentenced to 10 years in prison. I have a son as a direct result of my alcoholism. I never wanted to be a mother. I found out that is not adequate birth control. I didn't like this kid. He did nothing. He wept and he cried. You'd think at 8 months old he'd get a little part-time job. I didn't like him, but I was willing to use him that morning. I told the judge I was a single parent and I was self-supporting through my own contributions and I had this kid to take care of. And he told me he would put my son in a foster home because I was an unfit mother. And I've admitted to being a lot of things. I did not believe I was an unfit mother. I had that kid with me every day of the week, whether he wanted to be with me or not. And my son was to spend the first 11 months of his life in a plastic bathtub on a pool table in a smoke-filled bar. I thought because I had him with me made me a fit mother. And I'm trying to, and I'm going to prison. My son's going to a foster home. And in the middle of sentencing me, the expression on the judge's face changed. The tone of his voice got different. And I know he was as surprised at what he was saying as I was at what I was hearing. Because he looked at me and he said, I know this won't work for you, but I'm going to offer you an alternative. And part of that alternative was meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I wish I could tell you I took it. I came here, I heard the 12 steps and knew they were the solution to problems in my life, worked it all in the first week and skyrocketed to recovery. And sometimes when I'm out of state, I do tell that story, but that's not my story. I thought about it. Jail alternative. I've been to jail. There's more alcohol and other drugs inside the institution than there are some days on the street. If you know what to do, who to do it to, and you're willing to go to any lengths. And I always was. Jail alternative. I had the public defender standing next to me the day the $1,000 attorney was gone. The only thing I wanted to do since I was in the fourth grade was be a writer. I had an opportunity to go into that profession. I gave it up for one more drink. If it came between a job and a drink, I took a drink. A relationship and a drink, I took a drink. A family and a drink, I took a drink. Anything and a drink, I took a drink. I was 26 years old. I dragged myself out of my profession choice. I was unemployed and unemployable, and I had the public defender standing next to me, and I was being asked to make this decision, and I'm trying to figure it out, and I had that more. Bill writes something in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, something to this effect. It says, to be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis. And he goes on to say this is not always an easy choice for us, to be doomed to an alcoholic death. And I don't think by alcoholic death, I don't think Bill means having the decency to lay down and have put dirt on your face. I think the alcoholic death that Bill talks about is to continue to live in the despair, to continue to live in the incomprehensible demoralization, to continue to live sitting on bar stools, dreaming dreams and planning plans and not being able to get off the bar stool to get it done, to continue to live promising the people we love with every fiber in our body that we're not going to do it again, and we mean it from the top of our head to the tip of our toes. We are not going to do it again, and then we do it again. And then we see that look in their eye. Look, this is, why did you do it? You promised you weren't going to do it. Why did you do it again? I think that's the alcoholic death Bill talks about, to be doomed to an alcoholic death. We're to live on a spiritual basis. And if you're new here tonight, please hear this. This has not been an easy choice for any of us. It's not an easy choice. I had that morning, what I know tonight was a moment of clarity. Because as clear as I knew anything, I knew if I went to jail one more time, I'd either die in the institution or I'd become institutionalized for life. I didn't know why I knew it, but I knew it. I took the alternative, I left the courtroom, and I drank for 3 more months. In retrospect, I can tell you I didn't drink a greater quantity. Physically, it had been impossible to drink a greater quantity of alcohol, but I drank with a sense of urgency and a desperation that I had never known. And on October 4th, 1975, I walked into grace. I can tell you tonight that the grace of God has always surrounded me, but I have built a wall between me and God, and I could not access the grace. And on October 4th, 1975, I walked into grace. And I can tell you that tonight for this reason. That day, I didn't take a drink of alcohol. And I never planned to not take a drink of alcohol. I never tried to not take a drink of alcohol. It never occurred to me to not take a drink of alcohol. I have never tried to control my drinking. I've never tried to cut down. I've always simply drank. And on that day, I didn't take a drink of alcohol. And that night, I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was a speaker meeting. I can't tell you who talked that night, but I heard 2 things. I heard, we don't drink between meetings. Well, I quickly looked around and didn't see any of you drinking in the meeting. And I thought, if you're not drinking in the meeting and you don't drink between the meetings, when do you drink? I don't know how it impacts other newcomers, but it made me nervous. I couldn't figure out whether Judd sent me to a place where people didn't drink. I would have understood if he sent me to Sears School of Safe Driving. I did not understand why he sent me to a place where people didn't drink. And the other thing I heard is that the answers were in that book, Alcoholics Anonymous. So after the meeting, I stole the book. I mean, God knows I need to have the answers. I can't tell you how irritated I was. I went home and read the book. Not only could I not find the answers in there, I couldn't even find the questions. I thought, oh dear God, I've stolen the wrong book. I'm going to have to go back and get the right one. And that's the only reason I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I came back on Wednesday with 4 days of sobriety to get the answer book. It's the only reason I came back. I don't think it matters why you come back. I don't think it matters what your motive is, what your intentions are, what your desires are. I think what's critical is what your actions are. I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous to get the answer book. And I've been coming back to Alcoholics Anonymous ever since. My second meeting was a small discussion meeting. In that meeting, I heard, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it. I looked around the room, I looked around the room, I looked around the room. I could not figure out what it was you had that was so hot that I should be willing to go to any length to get it. I mean, look at the person next to you. Unless you're sleeping with him, what is it? I mean, I couldn't figure it out. And then I saw him, and I think there's a him for each of us. This guy was a skinny little fellow. He was bald-headed. He wore baggy pants. He had tennis shoes on with no shoelaces, and he nodded out during the meeting. And I quickly assessed the situation. I figured he was shooting heroin. Folks who shoot heroin nod out, and I can probably do this thing and not drink if I could shoot a little heroin. So I found out where he worked, and I snuck down to his office, and I said, Dick, I have to do this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous to stay out of jail, and I don't know how to do it. And he told me if I would go to meetings and read the book and talk to other alcoholics and not drink, so I guarantee you won't get drunk. If you don't get drunk, your life will get different. And I'm grateful he told it to me that way. He didn't tell me my life would get better. He didn't tell me my family life would get better, my relationships would get better, my finances would get better, my sex life would get better. He didn't tell me any of it would get better, and I'm grateful, because none of it has. It's a little hope for the newcomer, But it's all gotten different. And as I stand here tonight, I can tell you from the top of my head to the tip of my toes, I have never had it so good. See, I don't know good from bad for me. I'm going through something I think is good for me and turns out to be bad for me. I'm going through something I think is bad for me and it generally turns out to be good for me. And I'm rather dramatic. It's what I'm going through right now. I think this is the most heinous thing that could happen to me ever. Horrible, terrible thing. And I'm rather dramatic. I refer to it as the dark night of the soul. Unless, of course, you're going through it, then I just tell you, get over yourself. But my own experience is this. If I don't drink and don't die and don't drink and don't die, I'll move far enough beyond it to, in retrospect, see that every time I thought my life was falling apart, what was really happening is it was falling together. And it had to be exactly that way for God to move me to where He had me be. So I'm one of those people, I get content. I can tell you, right here, right now, my life is, well, not exactly today, but my life has been really, really good. My life, I get really content with life. I get so content that I dig a rut and I decorate it, and I'm really just happy right where I am. But there's a God that has such a bigger plan for me. God's plan for me is huge. God's plan isn't limited to what I'm content with. God's plan is huge. So sometimes God's got to come and kick me in the butt to get me out of that rut. And I think that's what happened to me on Monday. I think God kicked me in the butt to get me professionally out of that rut. And I don't drink and don't die and don't drink and don't die. It's been my experience that I have to go on experience. Then I'm going to get to the other side and see why it had to be exactly this way for God to move me to where He'd have me be. I believe that old man. I hadn't believed a human being in a long time, but I believe him. And my perspective is this. My life, people hurt me all my life. As a child, my parents told me they loved me anymore than their love and I had died. Their love was physically, emotionally, spiritually abusive. People told me they would be there for me and they weren't. They disappointed me, they hurt me, and they let me down. And I was over and over and over as a child, I was being hurt. And I made a decision as a small child. I just don't want to be hurt anymore. And I began to build a brick wall to keep you out. And that brick wall worked really well. It kept you out. What I didn't know is it made me a prisoner inside. I lived behind that wall in isolation and loneliness. And alcohol didn't allow me to come out and play. Alcohol just made it okay for me to be back there. And when you live behind a wall like that, you don't believe and you don't trust. And I hadn't believed a human being in a long time. But I believed that old man that morning. And I didn't know why then, but I know why tonight. I believed him because of the music of Alcoholics Anonymous. One alcoholic sharing with another alcoholic. One alcoholic sharing with another alcoholic goes through that brick wall. And I believe that old man. I have the books that open to the chapter that says, many of us are unwilling to admit we're real alcoholics. I'd say amen and close the book, and that was reading the book. I'd go down to the Canyon Club in Laguna Beach. I'd have a cup of coffee. On the way out, I'd say hi, Patty, or hi, Jim, to the manager. He'd say hi, Patty. That was talking to another alcoholic. My court program said I had to go to 2 meetings a week. I thought that was really obsessive. But I was willing to go to any length to stay out of jail. And the only thing I did right is I didn't drink. And I didn't drink, and I didn't drink, and I didn't drink. I pray God happens to everybody who's new what happened to me. I had the fortune of going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous where the men and women shared the way the book says to share. They talked about what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. And every time one of you talked about what it used to be like, your alcoholism touched mine. And you talked about what it used to be like, and your alcoholism touched mine, and your alcoholism touched mine, and your alcoholism touched mine. 8.5 months of sitting with you, my alcoholism woke up in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous because the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous shared the way the book says to share. I've been in pain in 37 years, but I have never been in the kind of pain that I was in 8.5 months away from my last drink. The pain of not drinking and not recovering. The pain of not drinking and not recovering is the greatest pain I've ever been in. And 8.5 months away from my last drink, my alcoholism woke up and that pain drove me to my knees. And on my knees, I admitted to my innermost self that I was alcoholic. And the book says this is the first step in recovery. I think Alcoholics Anonymous is probably the most powerful way of life ever known to man. I think the most powerful prayer that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous is the seven-step prayer. The seven-step prayer says something to this effect. It says, God, take all of me, good and bad. How powerful is that for an alcoholic of my nature? Take it all. I don't have to judge it anymore. Is it a good thing, a bad thing, a right thing, a wrong thing? Or my personal favorite, my will or God's will. We have the my will or God's will debate all the time around my area. And this is how I look at God's will for me. I set my GPS in my car and I start driving. Pretty soon she says to me, in 150 feet, turn right. Well, I have alcoholism. I don't have alcoholism. So 150 feet comes, I don't want to turn right. I want to turn left. So I turn left. My GPS doesn't say, Patio, you're a lousy driver. She just reconfigures the route. Do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. And pretty soon she'll say, in 75 feet, turn left. Well, in 75 feet, I don't want to turn left. So 75 feet, I want to make a U-turn. So I make a U-turn. My GPS doesn't say, Patty, you are the loudest driver in Southern California. Pull over, let somebody else drive. What are you doing? She just reconfigures it. I'm like an Al-Anon. They just keep reconfiguring the route. Eventually, you get to where you're supposed to be. And I think God's will works like that, too. I think God puts opportunities in front of me, and sometimes I look and say, you know what, I don't want that. I'm going to go around that. God doesn't say, Patty, you're a lousy member of AA. He just puts another opportunity up. I go, oh, I don't want it. I'm not interested in that. I go around that one. He doesn't say, Patty, you are the lousiest member of AA. Get rid of all your sponsors. Give them a chance to live. You know, get out of AA. He just puts another opportunity in front of me until I finally accept the opportunity. God just keeps giving me opportunities. So take it all, good and bad, right or wrong, God's will and my will. Who cares? Take it all. Leave me with this. Leave me with what I need to be of service to you and my fellow. How powerful is that? Selfish and self-centered. That's what walked through the doors. I've done very little. I admitted to my innermost self I was powerless. I came to believe the people in AA were telling me the truth. I made a decision to do what you said you had done. I wrote about my favorite topic, me. I bored somebody for about an hour and a half having to listen to it. And as a result of those very simple things, I'm now in a position where all I care about is being of service to God and my fellows. How powerful is that? And how simple. I think too many people miss it. Too many people miss it because they try to make it something different than what it is. Steps 8 and 9 for me are conventional ways of getting rid of conventional guilt. I felt guilty because I wasn't guilty. I did a lot of things to a lot of people for one more drink. And it wasn't just saying sorry. I said sorry all my life. Sorry, sorry, sorry. Then I do it again and get caught. Sorry, sorry, sorry. And then I do it again. So it wasn't just about saying sorry. It's about living my life different. But I don't know how. This is the only way I know how to live. I don't know how to live different than this. But you do. So I come here and you share what it's like today. And you talk about being a daughter and not taking a drink. And being an employee and not taking a drink. And being a parent and not taking a drink. And you allow me to take your experiences out in the world and live them. And they become my experiences. I am the woman I am tonight because the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous have continually shared with me what they are like today without taking a drink of alcohol. I got right with everybody in my life. I got right with my parents, my brothers and my sisters, my son, my employers, my former employers, San Diego Police, Orange County Sheriff. I got right with everybody in my life because I came here and I sat with you and you shared with me how you lived your life. You never told me how to live mine. You simply shared with me how you lived yours. 10, 11, and 12 are the steps that give me the privilege to stay in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. 10 says the process is powerful. Keep using it. Keep writing about it, talking about it. Ask God to remove the defect, make amends if necessary, and then turn your attention to somebody you can help. What is it I can do for you? How can I be of service? It seems to me when I'm focused on you, God can come in and take care of my problems. I'm focused on my problem. God can't do a thing about it. Step 11, my prayer in the morning is very simply, thy will be done. I'm so naive, I truly believe the rest of the day is God's business. My job is to not drink, show up, and live life to the fullest. The rest of the day is God's business. My prayer at night is a little scary or offers anybody who'd like to use it. My prayer at night is, dear God, please have people treat me tomorrow exactly the way I treated people today. And when I know I'm going to say that prayer tonight, it will hold me in good stead. I don't put people off on the freeway anymore. I still count, but I don't announce the number of items in the 10-item or less line at the grocery store. And I don't live my life too much out of virtue, as I know I'm going to say that prayer tonight. I challenge you to use it. I guarantee you if you use it for 90 days, it will change your life. And step 12 is the greatest gift you've ever given me, an opportunity to take a little of my past and give it to another alcoholic. To look into the eyes of another alcoholic and say, honey, you don't have to live that way. Take my hand, come with me, sit in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. My life today is beyond my wildest imagination. My son, who was 11 months old when I came to you, I brought him with me. My son grew up in this room on Friday night. We used to come to this meeting. I was one of the young people. I know that's hard to believe. We had dances here on Friday night. My son would spin around on the dance floor. He grew up with you. You taught my son everything he knows. You taught him how to love and be kind and be caring and be gentle. You also taught him how to con and manipulate, and I've never been thrilled with that, but apparently I have to take the good with the bad. And I share that with you for this reason. Just hanging out in AA were enough. My son would have never had a problem. Just hanging out here isn't enough. You got to do the work. And my son had a journey that alcoholic men go on. He went to places no human being should go, and he did things that no human being should do. At 17 years old, he left my home, and I got in the ring with his disease, and I'm powerless over alcohol, whether I'm fighting it because I'm drinking it or I'm fighting it because you're drinking it. If I get in the ring with alcohol, I lose. And I was in the ring with my son's disease, and I was getting beat up bad. He was in San Francisco. I was wiring him money. I tried going to Al-Anon, but they said, Patty, you're an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Please go back there. You're giving us a bad name. Because I couldn't do what they asked me to do, but I came here and I told you. I came here and I told you that he called me collect at work, and I cussed him out and hung up on him, and he called me collect at work, and I cussed him out and I hung up on him, and he called me collect at work, and I wired him the money. I had 7 MoneyGram stores going because I didn't want the 17-year-old clerk to know I was sending more money. I'd send from different MoneyGram stores and did everything wrong, but I told you. And the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous say, Patty, aren't you embarrassed? You're 23, 24 years sober. Aren't you embarrassed to be sharing this? I want you to know this. If I am ever too embarrassed to tell you the truth, I'm going to be drunk. I don't want to drink anymore. So I come here and I tell you the truth. On October 23rd, 2002, my son had moved back to Southern California, and he called me a collect at work one more time. And God did for me what I cannot do for myself. God won't do for me what I can do for myself. He won't send me money in the mail because I'm able to go to work. But he'll do for me what I cannot do for myself. Because when Patrick called that day, these words came out of my mouth, and I would have never spoken these words to my son. I said, Patrick, I can't help you anymore. Stay where you are. And I called a man in Alcoholics Anonymous, and thank God I called somebody who understood the traditions. Because he didn't say, tell the boy to call me. He said, where is he? And I gave him the address of the motel. He went and picked up a newcomer. They went and got my son, and they brought him to the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And for a little over 10 years now, you have done with him what you have done with me for 37. They didn't tell him what to do. They showed him what to do. And a few years later, into his recovery, he and I were sharing a pitch at the Saturday night meeting at the Canyon Club. He was a 10-minute speaker. And when he was doing his 10 minutes, he talked about the pain of growing up without a father. And I never knew that caused him any pain. I've been a single parent his whole life. I never knew that caused him any pain. But he told this room full of people about the pain of growing up without a father. And he said, but my mother's a blackout drinker, and I may never know who my father is. I thought, oh God, you've just outed me as a slut. And it was one of my proudest moments. I don't know too many parents that ever rocked their infant child and said, oh honey, one day one of my proudest moments is when you and I share a podium at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. My son is an active member of AA, was chair of ACIPA the year that it was in Orange County, and they had asked me to be the Saturday night speaker, and because he was chair, he chaired the Saturday night meeting. And when he introduced the speaker, he said, I want to introduce tonight's speaker, my mother and my hero. And I started to cry, and I thought about, how do you get there from where I was on October 4th, 1975, except for the power and the magic of the 12 steps to recovery. And I thought about that day in court when I was being asked to make that decision, to be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis. Norm Alpie, who was one of the most fabulous speakers Alcoholics Anonymous ever had, Norm used to talk about seconds and inches. Seconds and inches. If I'd have made a different choice in that courtroom that morning, my son would have gone to a foster home and he'd have been introducing somebody else that night. My mother and my hero. On November 29, 2006, I was in a hospital room at South Coast Medical Center when my grandson was born. And I was photographing the birth of my grandson because he always taught me in AA to have a job. If you want this meeting to be yours, have a job. Make coffee, set up, clean up, have a job. Don't just come here and sit, have a job. I've had jobs in every meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous I've ever had. I've always had a job, and I had a job that day. I was photographing the birth of my grandson. And at one point, the doctor looked at me and he said, this is a good shot. And I know a little about the female anatomy. I'm thinking, no, this is not a good shot. And just about then, my grandson's head was born. The doctor turned the head, and I looked into the eyes of God. And I looked behind him and his mother, and I looked into the eyes of God, and I looked behind her and my son, and I looked into the eyes of God. And I stood there that morning in that hospital. I realized that for, at that time, 31 years, a brick at a time. You have removed that brick wall that I have built between me and you. And you've allowed me to stand here and look into the eyes of God. And my grandson was born, he walked into my heart, and he changed my life. He's 6 years old, he's never done a single thing wrong. I get to have him every Tuesday night. I pick him up every Tuesday night, and one Monday, Patrick called me, and he was going to be late. He said, can you get Eden from school? Because in preschool, they charge you like $700 a minute if you're late. So I went, he said, certainly. I went to get him. I walked in his little schoolroom, and he came running up to me. He said, Grandma, Grandma, you might be confused. It's not Tuesday. And, on his fifth birthday, his mother had a bounce house birthday party for him, and I went to the birthday party early, and he was in the bounce house. He said, Grandma, Grandma, come on in the bounce house. And I'm not a bounce house kind of girl. I mean, but I'll do anything for him. I'll do anything for him. So I got in the bounce house, and he's trying to teach me how to do a bounce house somersault. And I'm not a good student. I'm not very agile, and I have COPD, and I'm having a terrible time in the bounce house. But he didn't lose his patience with me. He kept very patiently explaining how to do it and trying to help me get my legs over, and very patient, never lost his face. I finally did it. He squealed. He was so happy. And I was just thrilled to get out of the bounce house. And pretty soon some kids came, and he calls me to get in the bounce house because he wants me to show his little friends that I can do a bounce house somersault. And so I did it for them, and he's like all happy, and I get in, and then some more people come. I got to get back in and to show on, and then some more people come, and I just kind of automatically start falling in. And I said, okay, let me show you. And he said, no, Grandma, I don't want you to show them. I want you to teach them how to do a bounce house somersault. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is. This is like a big bounce house. It's a huge bounce house here. If you're new, come into our bounce house. All we want to do is teach you how to do a bounce house somersault. We're going to be really patient with you. We're going to be really patient. We're going to show you how to do it. We're going to try to help you. We're going to keep telling you. We're going to be very, very patient. And then we're going to ask you to show off for a few people because, you know, when we sponsor you, we like to show you off a little bit. We want to show you off, but then we're going to ask you to teach somebody else how to do a bounce house somersault. That's how AA works. I got my hand in my sponsor's hand, and I reached back for a newcomer. It takes a lot of courage and a lot of strength to continue to choose to recover. I'm going to have it. Coward's drink and use. I did that on a daily basis for 13 years. It takes a lot of courage and a lot of strength. I don't have it, but you do. So I come here. And when we pray tonight, the first time I write is going to give me a little courage. First time I left is going to give me a little strength. And you don't have to have 37 years, 30 years. You don't even have to have 1 year. If you have one day, you have courage to give to the person on your right, and you have strength to give to the person on your left. I can tell you, my grandson, if you offered me a shot of Jack Daniels, I would never give you my grandson for a shot of Jack Daniels. If you offered me a quart of Jack Daniels, I wouldn't give you my grandson for a quart. If you offered me a truckload of Jack Daniels, no way are you getting my grandson. Offer me the entire distillery. You're not getting them. But I'm going to tell you this. If I take one drink, I will give him up this quickly for the second one. And so I stay with you. I stay in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. I continue to get your courage. I continue to get your strength. When I was 4 days sober, an old man told me if I didn't drink, I wouldn't get drunk. And if I didn't get drunk, my life would get different. And he didn't lie to me. And I end with this. I always end with it. I end with it because it's been my experience. And I pray, God, it's your experience. And we already heard it tonight when chapter 5 was read. It's a line in chapter 5 that says, there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Thank you.